Good morning to you. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. We're pleased that you're listening. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about a controversial new disease which appears to be on the rise. It's called multiple chemical sensitivity. It is controversial because many people in the medical community doubt that it exists. It is a disease that, in its mildest forms, can cause typical allergy-like symptoms with rashes and stuffy nose. People who have severe cases have many symptoms, including things like chronic headaches, nausea, fatigue. Under extreme circumstances, this condition can be totally disabling. We'll be talking this morning about MCS with a guest who's written a book on the subject. His name is Peter Radetzky. He's a contributing editor of Discover magazine and also teaches in the science communication program at the University of California at Santa Cruz. His book on this subject is titled Allergic to the 20th Century, and it is published by Little Brown. It is out now if you'd like to take a look at it. And, of course, as we talk, if you have questions, they are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. If you match up the numbers with the letters on your telephone, you get WILL, so that might make it a little easier to remember. It's 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point here, you want to give us a call, we'd be happy to welcome you into the conversation. Well, Mr. Radetzky, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, yeah.
To start out, I guess we ought to define a little bit more clearly what we're talking about. What is multiple chemical sensitivity?
Well, it's sensitivity to chemicals in the environment that are usually taken for granted. And those chemicals can be anything from obvious ones like automobile and diesel exhaust, the products of combustion, natural gas stoves, and the like. Perfumes, which we may not think of as chemicals, as I quote someone in my book who suggests that most people think perfumes may be made by crushing sweet-smelling flowers together, but perfumes are chemicals, often petroleum-based chemicals. Formaldehydes, for example, which are used in cosmetics and drugs and insulation, all sorts of things. Food colorings is a real common one. It's hard to eat anything that doesn't have food colorings. Solvents, pesticides are very important, from the under-the-sink home pesticides to commercial industrial pesticides. These kinds of things that we live with every day take for granted, but in this controversial disease, these aren't taken for granted because the idea is they may cause a wide range of severe maladies.
Mm-hmm. Certainly we know that human beings have had allergies for a long time. It may be that certain kinds of allergies have been with us for forever or for as long as human beings have been around. At what point was the idea that allergic-like symptoms could be triggered by synthetic chemicals first acknowledged?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's especially interesting question because although allergies, traditional allergies, hay fever and the like, maybe have been with us as far back as we remember, the field of allergies is brand new. It is a turn of the century phenomenon where the idea of allergies was acknowledged and the mechanism for allergies was discovered. That's been going on in our century. So the medical profession's acknowledgement that there are undue sensitivities to common environmental constituents is new. So allergies itself is a new field. And allergies, when it began, was as controversial as multiple chemical sensitivity is now. But MCS, so-called, is really a product of maybe the last 40 years or so. And there was a doctor in Chicago by the name of Theron Randolph, who was really the first person to point toward environmental chemicals as being the cause of allergic-like symptoms. He was a traditional allergist who practiced in Chicago, and started seeing people who seemed to be suffering, well, who were suffering a wide range of maladies, and he couldn't put his finger on what was causing them. They weren't traditional allergy-like symptoms, sneezes, that sort of thing. They were the sort of symptoms you alluded to earlier, fatigue, nausea, brain fog, confusion, and worse. And after seeing a number of these patients and thinking about it, and he back in the 50s, used to take copious notes with patients by sitting there with his manual typewriter and typing out the results of his interviews with them. So he would have hundreds of pages of single-space notes on these people. He finally put two and two together and said, these are environmental problems. These are problems in our increasingly polluted environment that are causing these symptoms. And he was immediately drummed out of his profession, by the way, for saying so. But this was the beginning of an acknowledgement that maybe chemicals are causing these problems. So allergies itself is a new field. Multiple chemical sensitivity as a subset of these problems is brand new. Hmm.
Some of the symptoms, as you mentioned, some of the symptoms are indeed allergy-like, the things like skin rash, for example, or difficulties breathing, watery eyes, sinus effects, the kinds of things that we see, for example, with people who have pollen allergies or have food allergies. Sometimes people report gastric symptoms, which you certainly see with food allergies. So that would suggest that possibly this is something similar. Other people show kind of symptoms that you might actually see with certain kinds of poisonings, so that it's more of a toxic kind of effect. And I suppose that one of the things that makes it more difficult and does create a lot of discussion in the field is whether indeed this is an allergy, and that's the proper word to use, or it is something else. And I suppose one might also take it one step further and ask, is that really an important question? Does it really matter whether it's a true allergy or not?
I don't think it matters to the patient, certainly, but it matters a lot to medical people. And I think it's one of the reasons for the ongoing controversy and enmity between various groups in the medical professions. Is this an allergy? Is it something else? Interestingly, David, I entitled this book Allergic to the 20th Century, but people who suffer these environmental problems have come to me and said, no, these aren't allergies at all. This title does a disservice to this whole problem. So even some patients are concerned that they want the world to know that what they're suffering isn't the same thing as hay fever. It's something has different mechanisms, perhaps, and has more serious consequences. In the medical field, there are two groups that have various stances on this issue, and one group is the traditional allergists who look at this problem and say, we can't find the same mechanism going on here that we can in allergies, and the symptoms are too wide-ranging. They're not like those we see in allergies, so this, number one, isn't an allergy, and number two, we doubt that it's a physiological problem at all. Then there's a subset of allergists that call themselves environmental physicians, sometimes call themselves clinical ecologists, and they say, oh no, these may not be traditional allergies, and the mechanisms may be different, but these are physiological. These people are suffering from exposures, and we need to find new ways of dealing with this problem. The two groups don't get along very well. In a way, they're fighting for the same or a similar patient population. It may be some turf wars going on here. But a lot of this does come back to the definitions of what these maladies might be. Hmm.
I suppose that there is yet another possibility, and that is that you take someone who, to begin with, does indeed have some sort of allergy. You know, people can be allergic to a lot of things, foods, pollens, dust mites, animal hair, and then you can also trigger allergic-like reactions, you know, reactive airway problems by breathing smoke, again, by some of those other things. So, I mean, and you may start with something like that, and can make this person very uncomfortable, can have a lot of difficulties. And perhaps over time, they might somehow get the idea that other things they come in contact with are producing the same reaction, and you layer these on one over another over time. And then indeed, you could construct a sort of a scenario for a person to decide indeed they are allergic to virtually everything that they come in contact with. And that's not necessary to say that, and then one might say, well, that's psychosomatic, and it may indeed be induced in that way. That's not to say that that person isn't suffering, because of course the symptoms may indeed be real, but what you have to ask yourself is, well, what is the cause? Is it really possible for someone perhaps to start with some problem, a small problem, and then for them to convince themselves that they have a larger problem than they really started out with?
Well, I think, sure, it's possible, and we probably all know instances where that's happened in situations that have nothing to do with the kinds of reactions we're talking about here. So yes, the mind is a powerful thing, and it contributes to every illness or every problem. And the scenario you've outlined is precisely the scenario that people who look at this problem and say this is psychogenic, these people need psychologists, not physiological doctors, that's the scenario they advance, that their minds are pushing symptoms on them, and they're starting to get scared of everything they come in contact with. And I don't doubt that there are some people for whom this is true. Typically, people who describe this problem say that their first exposure, and they can often point to a first exposure, was not a traditional allergy-like exposure to a pollen or dust mites or something. But their first exposure was to an environmental chemical. Pesticides is a common one. Perfumes can be another. And typically, although this isn't always the case, these exposures were very low grade, at levels that we take for granted, we don't blink at. And for these people, typically, those exposures were what triggered the rest of the problems, which came on over time. Now, one thing that I tried to suggest in the book is that there are ways of testing this. There are ways of testing people's reactions to exposures. There are animal studies that are ongoing to test if it's possible that low-grade exposures can cause this panoply of symptoms. And there are studies, especially those with respect to military problems, and Gulf War Syndrome is an interesting topic in relation to all of this, that suggests that low-grade exposures can indeed cause these problems. So I think that this question, whether this is primarily psychogenic or whether it's primarily physiological or maybe a mix of the two, can start to be answered as more research is done, research in mainstream institutions that can be accepted by both sides that start to answer some of these problems. That's one of the things I'm pushing for in the book, but that hasn't been done so far.
Our guest this morning is Peter Radetzky. He's contributing editor of Discover Magazine. He also teaches in the Science Communication Program at the University of California at Santa Cruz. He is the author of the book Allergic to the 20th Century. It's published by Little Brown. And if you have questions, you can call. We have our lines full, so we will move to the phones and start talking with some people who are listening. We'll begin with the caller in Peoria, line number 4.
Yes, hello. Good morning, Mr. Radetzky. What about the home? All of this man-made material that we have in the home today, like your carpeting, paint, clothing, drapes, mostly is man-made, and a lot of people are allergic to those things.
You bet. People who suffer this problem point to the home as being one of the primary offenders. That's good news and bad news, I think. The bad news is that these are common building materials in homes and furnishings in homes. They're the sorts of things we live with every day, and so it's hard to get away from them. The good news is that we do have some control over what happens in our homes. That's one thing we can do something about. And I interview a number of people in this book who have turned over their homes, made their homes safer for them by getting rid of the kinds of exposures that they consider to be difficult for them.
How about letting a little fresh air into the home?
That's opening a window. You know, there's a phenomenon called sick building syndrome. And the idea is that certain buildings can build up a store of these exposures and can make people sick. And that's a phenomenon that's come about since the Second World War, and in particular since the energy crisis of a couple of decades ago, when buildings were built so tightly, so airtightly, that you can't open a window and let in outside air. So I think your suggestion is a very good one.
Yeah, but they have schools now that you can't open the windows.
That's what I'm
saying.
They're
both that way. Buildings are the same way. There's no way of opening a window.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. And that leads to this phenomenon of sick building syndrome. So it's a problem that people have to deal with. But the main thing is recognizing the problem, and then there are ways of trying to do something about it.
Thank you.
All right. We'll go to next someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I guess I'm one of the people that they consider to be crazy. I suffer from all these chemical sensitivities, and before that, I've been seeing an allergist, and I was getting shots, and then I became very ill in my work environment. I'm a trader on the floor of Chicago World Options Exchange, and I got sick originally when I was on the floor of the exchange. I was having sinus problems. I was getting dizzy. I was, feeling weak. I would get body aches and pains. I go to my allergist with problems. I was having asthma attacks on the floor. One day I couldn't breathe. And I went to my allergist. He'd give me a shot of cortisone, a dose of prednisone. I'd be fine. I'd improve. I'd go back to work, then get sick again. I started losing money. I was a very successful trader, six figures every year, and then things just started going downhill. I deteriorated. My health deteriorated. I went and I had a sinus surgery and, rounds of antibiotics, and I just kept getting sicker. So after my surgery, I saw an environmental physician on television, and I have all these symptoms. I didn't even know what this illness existed. I went there, and lo and behold, they tested me for chemicals. I reacted to every chemical they tested me for. I went down to Dallas, Dr. Ray. I guess you may or may not have heard of him. I guess you did, though. William Ray in Dallas. I went to the Environmental Health Center there. And I was diagnosed, and now I had a disability policy. My disability carrier stopped paying me, and now I'm in litigation with him. I guess my question is, how the court's handling these cases.
Yeah. Your sad experience is typical of many of the people that I interviewed for this book, and I do indeed know of Bill Ray and his Environmental Health Center in Dallas. I spent a good deal of time there, and he's profiled in the book, and I've talked to many patients who have been there. Before I answer your question, my question to you is, did it help you? Are you doing any better having seen these people?
I'm doing better when I stick to the program. The problem is, I'm allergic to so many things. It's hard for me to stick to the program. I can't. I used to be like a person. I'd be out all the time. I'd be doing things all the time. Always active. I was a trader on the floor of the exchange, and I was, real active. And it's like I can't. I can't eat wheat anymore. I can't drink anymore. I can't expose myself to any chemicals. And I'm always in pain. I always have a headache. I always have my ears ring constantly. I always have aches, body aches, pains. But I keep going. I just go forward with it. If I stay on a diet where I just eat meats and vegetables, they have me taking the vitamins and the minerals, and I take enzymes to digest my food. Blah blah blah. The whole bit.
I feel for you deeply. And this is the extreme of where this kind of problem can go, where this gentleman, as he says, he's just reacting to just about everything, and how do you get away from everything? I think there's been some success in the courts. It depends on the cases, but there's one fellow I interview in the book who is convinced that the only way changes are going to be made are through the courts. And people like yourselves need to take these problems to the court.
Oh, I'm there.
Yeah, to convince people that they're going to lose money unless some changes are made. when it gets down to economic concerns, sometimes things change, and there are good examples of that. The fight against the tobacco company is one of those. The fight against automobile companies to get seat belts and the like is another. Where it starts to hit the pocketbook, sometimes changes can be made. So you may be taking the course that's best for you and best for many people by bringing this out in the law courts and forcing change in that way.
Yeah, well, I've certainly felt it in my pocketbook. I lost
indeed
a great career I had gone.
Yeah, indeed. And I think the largest answer, the final answer, is we're going to have to do something about the environment. We can try and change our own homes, our own personal environments. We can do what you've done, which is do the best you can living in the world. But if the world is increasingly dominated by chemicals, often toxic chemicals, it becomes increasingly more polluted, all of us are going to suffer. And people who suffer like you often consider themselves to be canaries in the coal mine.
Right.
Kind of advanced scouts. Right. Telling the rest of us that we may be suffering now, but the rest of you are next.
it just hit me first, yeah.
Yeah. So it may be a call to arms, you know, a call to action. You may be providing that by going to the courts, and I certainly wish you the best.
Okay, thank you, Doctor.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. We are about midway through. To reintroduce our guest, we're speaking with Peter Radetzky. He is a contributing editor of Discover Magazine. He also teaches in the Science Communication Program at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Is it usually the case that we have someone like the last caller? How many people are sensitive to a very long list, and do we have some people who are sensitive to two things, and some that are sensitive to five things, and some that are sensitive to 20, or is it most often the case that when multiple really does mean multiple, and we have people who have a very wide range of sensitivity, perhaps in fact so wide it would be difficult to determine just what things they are sensitive to?
Yeah, I think the answer to your question is in the way you asked it, that there seems to be a continuum here, that typically people are exposed to one kind of chemical, and over time their sensitivities widen. It's called the spreading phenomenon in the view of some of the people I talk to, that their sensitivities spread to other chemicals, and particularly to chemicals in combination. Combinations of chemicals, to the point that, as in this last gentleman's situation, they seem to be sensitive to just about everything. Now, how many people does that affect? It's real hard to pin this down. The National Academy of Sciences did a study, and they found that some 15% of our population, that's about 40 million people, consider themselves to be sensitive to one or more chemicals. How many people are sensitive to many chemicals? Well, there was a study done at the University of Arizona that suggested that maybe 60% of people are sensitive to one or more chemicals. That would be 160 million people. I'm in correspondence with lots of people around the country that are suffering this problem, and one person told me recently that they figured out that maybe 2.5%, and this was a group from New Mexico, people in New Mexico have debilitating multiple chemical sensitivity. That's a lot of people, 2.5% of 250 million people in this country. You can do the math yourself. So we're talking about large, large numbers here. But again, it usually starts sensitivity to one exposure and then typically spreads to sensitivities to many. And I may say also that this gentleman's story is typical in that he went to traditional doctors, allergists, who treated this problem like an allergy, and it didn't seem to do any good for him. And he finally ended up at an environmental physician, in this case maybe the most famous environmental clinic there is, the Environmental Health Center in Dallas, that's run by Dr. Bill Ray. And remedies they prescribe there seem to be helping him if he can stay on them, but it's tough. So that's a typical story. The traditional medical establishment did nothing. The non-traditional medical establishment seemed to help to a greater or smaller degree. but he was forced there because nothing was happening for him, and now he's trying to have to fend it off by himself and is going to court to do it. I'm not a medical doctor, and when I was writing this book, I felt so helpless in many cases because all I could do was describe. And people, since I've written the book, people come to me with these questions and say, what can I do? And I can only describe what other people have done. So this is a tough one, and it tears your heart out to see how people are suffering because of it.
Let's talk with some other callers. We'll go next to Effingham, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Timely subject. I had a friend who was exposed to the chemical Busun, isocyanate, and I was wondering if you could tell me where I could find out more information about this chemical and what the sensitizers are.
Oh, you know, I can't tell you specifically. Are you on the internet?
Yes, I have it available.
Okay, there are lots of places you can find out about chemicals on the internet. And in the back of my book, I have websites as well as phone numbers to call for more information about a variety of things. So I would suggest you surf the net, maybe take a look at the back of the book for some of these sources and do that kind of research. But I'm sorry I can't help you on this specific one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. We'll go on to Champagne, line number three. Hello.
Hello. So far, it seems like I've mostly heard you talk about conventional Western medicine and treating of symptoms, taking sort of a allopathic approach. I'm wondering, have you looked at all into approaches such as traditional Chinese medicine that instead of treating symptoms tries to, through acupuncture or herbal medicine or other treatments, to treat the entire organism and try to rebalance the whole system, thus eliminating the symptoms?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's one of the theories that environmental physicians ascribe to for this problem is the theory of total body load. And they say, look at the body as though it's a rain barrel. And into that rain barrel is pouring all of the exposures and stresses we have in our life. And that might be exposures to chemicals. It might be infectious microbes. It might be a fight with your mate or a hard day at the office, that is psychological stress. It might be injury. All these things that impinge on our lives pour into the barrel. And little by little, that barrel fills up. And when it's just about at the top, you may come into contact, you may be sitting in traffic and you're inundated in diesel exhaust, or you may have exposure to perfume, something that causes that barrel to overflow. Now, what's the cause, and you get sick. Now, what's the cause of that problem? Was it the last exposure, that perfume or that chemical? Or is it the sum total of exposures that caused the water to rise so high? That's a holistic approach. And that's the kind of approach I think you're suggesting that non-traditional Eastern medicines, for example, give to this type of illness. I quote some people in the book that have gone that route. It's all anecdotal because there haven't been studies that I know of that have shown what Eastern medicine can do for these things. Most of the people go the Western way, but I might suggest that these non-traditional Western practitioners incorporate the ideas of Eastern medicine and other medicines into their treatments. It may be that these treatments do a lot of good, and since these patients often find no relief by the traditional allopathic Western approach, they're starting to explore these new ways, and I would encourage people to do so.
Just a semantic point, I prefer to use conventional medicine for the Western approach because it's some ways the kind of the new kid on the block. It's only been around, you know, a couple of hundred years as opposed to traditional approaches which are thousands of years old.
I think that probably fits better, yes.
All right. Thank you very much.
We'll go to next caller in Danville, line number four. Hello.
Hi. I'm sitting in a room with several people that suffer from chemical sensitivity. One of them is methyl ethyl glyco. We have dealt with a sick building syndrome. The building was tested three times. It all of the levels were below OSHA levels.
Yes.
However, there are probably 20 people with various illnesses. I was treated for asthma for a long time. One girl had severe or has still being treated for rheumatoid arthritis. Another one, breathing problems and taken out by ambulance, several people. The building, they say, is still safe because it's below OSHA levels.
Yeah.
But people are still experiencing problems. My lungs fill up if I go into the building, which I no longer do. I went to the National Jewish Hospital. I have heard Dr. Ray talk. He's the doctor that has does the exchange on your blood.
That's one of the things I believe he does, yeah.
Okay. We have a couple questions. One, how do you get physicians to listen? Two, does your immune system ever rebuild itself? And three, does his exchange of blood, does it work for any of us?
Right. Good. Well, good questions. How do you get doctors to listen? Boy. That's one of the big problems with this malady. How do you get doctors to listen? I'm hoping that the kind of publicity that is engendered by what we're doing today on the radio or by my book or by any people that come public with this problem, by this gentleman earlier going to court, will cause doctors to sit up and say, hey, this is something I have to learn about. And maybe that will help. I think you people doing as much talking to doctors and other people about your problem as you can will help. The word has to get out that no matter the cause, this is a real problem and a growing problem, and people need to take a look at this problem rather than sloughing it off as something that's not real and you people are crazy and don't waste my time. I mean, that's a horrible attitude, and it exists out there, and I think people just have to persevere to stop that. As far as do the treatments work at the Environmental Health Clinic, they seem to work. They tell me at the clinic that they work for some 90% of their patients. Patients I interviewed who had been to this clinic and other clinics say that, yes, they were helped. Can the immune system ever recover? This is a work in progress with these people, you know. This malady, as recognized, is so new that people have to study this longer, and people have to live longer with the problem to see if people come all the way back. As far as the people that I interviewed for this book, and I interviewed many people, the situation's varied. There's some happy stories in this book where people have recovered to a large degree and are living their lives, if not the same, very near to the lives they lived before they were afflicted. So I think that's very hopeful. There are other people in this book who haven't recovered that well and are still on this path and are still trying to find the key that will help them get back to where they were. So they're on their way. So I think the prospect is hopeful, but it's not yet clear about how far back you're going to come. But I think it's real important for everyone with this problem to make the problem known, to get out and talk to people, to let people know that you're not crazy, that this is real, and that what we need to do is to find out more clearly the causes of these problems and then how to deal with them. And your testimony that your building is, the exposures are below federal standards, that's a common thing, you know. And it makes me think of Gulf War syndrome, where the military said to these soldiers that chemical exposure is not dangerous at all unless it's high exposure. Low exposure means nothing. So don't worry about low exposures in the Gulf. We know now that hundreds of thousands of soldiers may have been exposed to low or higher doses of chemicals in the Gulf. Over 100,000 vets have come back and registered with the government as suffering Gulf War syndrome, which is the same range of symptoms that you people are suffering. Yet the military had told them, don't worry about this. And now at least one study has surfaced, a military-funded study from a couple of decades ago, that has suggested that low-grade exposure, exposures considered to be safe, can lead in the long term to these symptoms. So maybe the regulations in this case simply aren't useful. So I wish you luck and persevere. There are resources out there. It's difficult to find them sometimes, but I think, as one person in my book told me, I've had to become my own expert.
I have too.
Yep. And I think that's what you have to do, because there's no establishment that's going to help you. I hope this will change, but I don't think it's going to change quickly.
I think vitamins and drinking lots of water and lots of air, but I can walk down a street and tell you who's fertilized their yard and who hasn't.
Well, I bet you can, too.
And I
bet you can, yeah.
It's unbelievable how it changes your life.
That's the thing, and that's the gulf between people who have experienced this and people who haven't. People who have experienced this problem can tell you, just as you've said, you can't believe what this done to my life. I mean,
I was in a restaurant having lunch with a neighbor one time. The door just opened to the kitchen, and I could smell gas. Someone was walking across with a cigarette to go in the kitchen, and I stopped them, and I said, there's a gas leak. They went in and checked. There was a gas leak. It's like a blind person. You suddenly are so acutely aware of your surroundings that people think you're crazy.
I know. You know, there was a program on the ABC television program 2020 last week. I don't know if you saw it.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't.
It was a rerun. I think this has been run maybe three times now. A look at multiple chemical sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
It was a horrible shot. It's from the most biased, narrow point of view.
We had girls come into our office from the sick building, and they brought maybe 3 inches of files within a very short time. Two of the girls got sick. My hands start swelling up. My feet start swelling up.
Yeah.
I was having trouble.
Yeah.
So we, you know, everything has to be taken out of here.
Yeah. Oh, I know it. I know it. But the world at large doesn't recognize that yet. I hope all of us can band together to make that change.
Well, we appreciate you writing a book, and we will all read it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call.
Good luck to you.
It sounds as if, isn't the ultimate bottom line that if people are having these kinds of reactions to certain chemicals, that what really to be cured of symptoms, or to not to experience symptoms, there's nothing else for it except to do everything they can to not to expose themselves to that chemical.
Yeah, well, avoidance seems to be the number one remedy that everyone I talk to suggests, that there's no better thing you can do than to avoid that particular chemical. Now, that can put people in a real fix. How do you avoid the chemicals of modern life? I mean, it's next to impossible. And I have a whole section in this book profiling people who have, I mean, they've moved from their jobs. They've moved from their homes. They've moved to different areas in the country that they considered to be less inundated with chemicals. And they found some relief in that regard. Those are the extreme kinds of things. But who can move? I tell the story of another person in this book who is just trying to find housing that she can tolerate. And I follow her around Tucson, Arizona, trying to find a place where she can live. She doesn't have the resources to get out and move. I mean, it's a terrible, intractable sort of thing. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, people may argue this is all in the head, this is not real, this is in the body. At a certain point, it doesn't matter, because these people are suffering. And the thing to do now is to look at this with an open mind, find out the causes. They may be a combination of physiological and psychogenic. I mean, we are one organism. But still, those problems can be dealt with. The thing is to find out the causes and what to do about it, instead of arguing whether it's real or not and that sort of thing. There are too many stories like the ones these callers have given today that suggest that people are suffering for reasons that we may not fully understand, but we need to take a look at them with an open mind.
Well, we have a few other callers. We'll try to get in some more folks before we find ourselves out of time to introduce our guest once again. We're speaking with Peter Radetzky, and his book is Allergic to the 20th Century, published by Little Brown. We will go to next someone in Aurora, and that's line one. Hello.
Yeah, I just have some comments to make. I recently spoke with a woman who came here from Romania, and she was telling me how terrible the environment is in Romania, and she says, you know, you really can't live there anymore. I hadn't heard that, but I really believed her. The other thing I wanted to comment about, all the monosodium glutamate that's in the food and the backs of packages, if you read the packaging of prepared foods, all the chemicals that are in it, I don't know how you get away from it, but just strictly cooking, you know, doing basic cooking. And the other thing I wanted to comment about, I have tried to get a shampoo without chemicals in it, and it's, I don't know where to go anymore to get, because nobody ever talks about all the chemicals that are in shampoo.
Right. It's next to impossible to get these chemicals out of our lives. I know exactly what you're saying. There are email servers, you know, and groups of people who are sensitive to chemicals, and a lot of what they talk about every day, over and over and over, is where can I find a good shampoo? Where can I find some way to wash my dishes that won't make me ill? How can I find clothing to wear that doesn't have the kinds of chemicals that make me ill, and so on and so forth. On and on and on, it can be very difficult to do. How can I eat foods that won't make me ill? You're touching at the very heart of this problem.
The other thing I wanted to comment, and I know I don't sound very kind about this, but I think this is a thing that we can't be kind about. I'm quite glad, should I use that word, that the Amoco building is sick, that the sick Amoco building in Naperville, that a big company like that is having problems, because maybe somebody will do something about it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it will. Again, when it comes down to economic concerns where it hits people in the pocketbook, that's when things start to change.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. We'll go again to another caller. This is Muhammad, and it's line two. Hello.
Hi. First of all, I wanted to say hi to Peter Radetzky. I took a class from him at UCSC many years ago.
Oh, what is your name?
My name at the time was Tina Freeman.
Nice to talk to you again.
Thanks. Speaking of UCSC, back in those days, in the photography classes, they often had the kids working with the chemicals directly, with their hands in the chemicals rather than using tongs. And I often wondered if my later rather mild sensitivity to certain things dated from that time, because I know of some other artists and photographers who've had problems with sensitivities from working with paints and whatnot. And at this point, I just am, you know, sensitive to, like, I have to take a day off of work if they're painting or installing carpeting or something like that. But I wondered, you know, did you encounter any artists or photographers who worked with chemicals and paints, and if they had problems?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that could be a typical first exposure. I don't know for sure if it was yours or your friends, but that's a typical story where that kind of exposure leads to more exposures. And the woman I was talking about in Tucson trying to find a place was an artist who had those kinds of exposures, and now she suffers terribly from a wide range of exposures. So yeah, that sort of thing sounds typical.
Yeah, I think that they've pretty much ignored, back in those days, this was in the 70s, you know, there wasn't a lot of safety precautions, I don't think. Maybe they've improved. But the other place I've noticed a lot of problems is in motel rooms.
Yeah, oh boy. Motel rooms, hotel rooms, apartments, you know, they're all sprayed with pesticides. They use these strong astringents to sterilize things.
Right.
Like. And I really don't suffer these except in a very, very mild way. I have traditional allergies. I've been in motel rooms where I couldn't stand being in there.
Right.
The smell was too strong. So that's right. It's all around us, you know. it's a terrible problem. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm glad you're going ahead with work.
All
thanks
right,
a lot.
Thanks for the
Thank
call.
You.
Bye-bye.
I suppose that, again, what makes it more complicated is that a prolonged exposure to virtually anything, and you can see it in particular occupations, can become a problem. I don't recall now exactly what the context was, but I was talking with someone who was talking about how some healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, people like that, are developing allergies to latex.
Yes.
And it's because there's those gloves that they wear all day long, and probably other sorts of things that they handle constantly. I remember years ago I met a man who had been in the upholstery business all of his life, and at that time he was probably probably in his 60s or something, and he had become allergic to the very material that he was using every day to upholster chairs. And at that point, the only thing in the whole operation that he could do is he could cut the cushions because he could handle it. But that I think it was the, you know, and all of his clothing had to be cotton, and he couldn't handle polyester or anything like that because he'd become allergic to it. And I guess because it was handling it constantly, touching it, breathing it day after day after day, that did it. And I guess almost anything.
That's very interesting. And you know, with traditional allergies, there seems to be a genetic component. Because people understand the mechanism of allergies, they can see that some people have a stronger predilection to have that physiological mechanism than others. There seems to be a genetic component, and there's only a certain percentage of people that have this genetic component. There may be something like this going on with this also, that certain people are more sensitive to these kinds of things than others because of genetics. That remains to be determined. But that may suggest why somebody can get through a whole career, let's say in the upholstery industry or in medicine or somewhere else, and not have these exposures, where someone else over time becomes sensitive to the very implements of his or her career, the life. One of the doctors I quote in this book suggests that people with sensitivity self-select themselves out of professions that are heavy with exposures. People who are real sensitive to certain chemicals, formaldehyde being one, aren't going to be docs, because once they're exposed to formaldehyde a lot in the dissecting room, for example, they're going to find that another profession is best for them. And so it goes. And that may, she suggests in the book, account for some of the bias in the medical profession against this as being a physiological malady. They don't suffer this problem. How could other people? There's a lot of gender bias, other biases, a lot of sociology here, David, that's very interesting that I try and get to in this book as well.
Well, I'm so sorry to say that we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. I'm sure that we could continue, but there we must leave it. I want to thank you very much, Peter, for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, David. I enjoyed it.
And for people who would like to read the book, once again, the title is Allergic to the 20th Century by Peter Radetzky, Radetsky, pretty much like it sounds, and it's published by Little Brown. It's out now.